had to turn my phone off. I told Obama to call me and tell me what to say. That was beautiful. Thank you for letting me speak to you. It's a privilege to speak to you guys about Muhammad Ali or to speak to you about anything. And I think I haven't told you recently how pretty you are, so I want you to know how pretty you are. Ali would start fights with his face in the face of Bundini Brown. And they said, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, rumble, young man, rumble. Today we will rumble with Ali in our sanctuary. If, as I present him, you think that I loved him or appreciated him, well, I hope you grow your appreciation for him. My intent is that we can learn from Muhammad Ali. Integrity is the topic of the month. January is the birth month of Dr. King and Muhammad Ali. Both work for peace, love, and social justice. How could this kid from Louisville transition to the people's champion? As I rumble today, consider the roles of integrity and search for religion in your life and in the life of this church. Violence, as Obama said, is contrary to what he taught us. At one point he asked, why would anyone want to cause pain for others or for themselves? But boxing was his venue. Sports fans always knew who was the heavyweight champion. For blacks, boxing was particularly noticeable. For the uneducated, it was a way to fame and fortune. Joe Louis carried black image as champion for 12 years. Boxing was run by white people, mostly the mafia. Joe Louis had rules such as never have a picture taken with a white woman. Joe Louis was relatively nonverbal. He knew his place. He died as a greeter in a casino in Las Vegas. There are three main points of integrity for Ali, choices that made him more than a boxer. I'm going to refer to them as rounds. That's a coincidence. I divide it into three rounds. Pretend you hear a bell. Round one, he discovered and immersed himself in the Muslim religion. Second round, he refused to enter the military. Third round, he did not hide behind Parkinson's. Ding, ding, ding. Round one, transition from Baptist Cassius Marcellus Clay to the Muslim and heavyweight champion of the world, Muhammad Ali. Clay, like others, believed boxing could be a road to wealth and fame. He trained hard and disciplined himself. As a teen, he said, I will be the heavyweight champ. He won local events and was an easy interview, becoming known as the Louisville Lip. He traveled with boxing to big cities that introduced him to a wider world. His IQ measured at 83. His grades were poor. Some teachers did not want him to graduate from the all-black Central High School. The principal said, there is no way that Clay will not graduate from my high school. He recognized Clay's charisma and predicted that one day Clay would be the heavyweight champ. Clay was allowed to do an oral final paper. He spoke of his travels with boxing as the school would not allow him to speak on black Muslims. When he crossed the stage at graduation, his classmates gave him a standing ovation. He did not understand why Negroes in Louisville could not eat at certain restaurants, or had to watch movies in the balcony, or could not attend the local amusement park. He had earlier been moved by the story and pictures of Emmett Till, the black man who had been beaten and lynched in Mississippi. He wins an Olympic gold medal. He becomes known as the mayor of the Olympic Village. Participants from around the world wanted to be with Cassius Clay. It was clear that he had mastered the skill of being the center of attention. He continuously practiced speaking and entertaining. When Ali came back to the USA, he was introduced to Harlem. Black Muslims were speaking on the street corners. They did not get into trouble. He met Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad and quietly grew those relationships. He immersed himself in the Muslims. He didn't hide what he was doing, but he was not totally open. He knew that his faith might be detrimental to his career. After winning several professional fights, Clay bugs the heavyweight champion Sonny Liston with threats and statements of beauty and greatness. all designed to rile Liston into giving him a chance. Eventually, Liston relented. He seemed to think, as the reporters did, this kid will be easy. Reporters found out about the Muslims and wrote detrimentally about Clay and the religion. The fight was not a full house, but there was a large following on pay-per-view. At the press conference, Ali was out of his mind. He got his blood pressure up to 200 over 110. He said crazy things. He wanted Liston to believe he was crazy. One time he drove his bus up to Liston's home, woke him up, and threatened him. As you know, Clay and Ali often wrote poems. I want to read you part of the poem he wrote to Sonny Liston. Now Clay swings with a right, what a beautiful swing, and the punch rises the bear, actually, he called him the ugly bear, clear out of the ring. Liston is rising, the ref wears a frown, he can't start counting till Sonny comes down. Now Liston disappears from view, the crowd is getting frantic, but our radar find him up over the Atlantic. Who would have thought when they came to the fight they'd witness the launching of a human satellite? The crowd did not dream when they lay down their money they would see the total eclipse of the sunny. Clay was a 7-1 underdog in that fight. That meant if you bet $7 on Clay, you'd get $1 back. Liston had won the title by demolishing the then champion Floyd Patterson in one round. One author said, to watch Liston overcome Patterson is to watch the defeat of civilization by something so elemental and primitive it cannot be named. Liston was a bad man. Clay later admitted he feared Liston. People wondered about serious injury. Clay's trainer, Angelo Dundee, knew the quickest route to the local hospital. But one cannot hit a butterfly. The dancing he did was beautiful. Really, even if you don't like fighting, it was beautiful. Even nearly blinded for part of round five, Clay prevailed. Liston did not answer the bell for the seventh. 22-year-old Clay won his 21st professional fight. Clay was a madman in the ring, yelling, "I am the greatest. I am the prettiest." And he leaned over the rail, talking to reporters, and said, "You were wrong. I am the world's champion of the heavyweight division." The championship was followed with more questions about his faith. Whites were appalled, and many blacks not supportive of this obscure Muslim religion. The religion respected blacks but called for the separation of races and said the white man was the devil. The message was much different than Dr. King's appeal for equality and integration. Ali's willingness to stand up, though, energized the black community. They noticed his courage. Shortly after this fight, Ali's conversion was complete. Elijah Muhammad bestowed on him the name of Muhammad Ali, Muhammad meaning one worthy of praise, and Ali meaning lofty. Changing his name was itself controversial. Many refused to call him by his new name. Sports writers and boxing opponents continued to derisively refer to him as Cassius Clay. He asked some of them as he beat them, "What's my name? What's my name?" The second Liston fight was moved to Lewiston, Maine, because many did not like or support either fighter. They did not like his religious change. He was now Muhammad Ali, yet the fight was officially called the second Clay-Liston bout. He knocked Liston out in the first round. The fight produced one of the most iconic pictures in sports. This is the one Obama talked about. Madonna has this picture in her Ali room. It says, "To Madonna, we're both the greatest." The title of this is Get Up and Fight. That's what he's saying to Liston right there. Get up and fight. He didn't think he could knock Liston out in the first round. It's an important picture, though. It's David over Goliath, hope over oppression, youth over experience, the butterfly and bee over the behemoth. You will often see this photo in movies and in television shows in the home or office, usually of a black person. Gibbs's boss in NCIS has this picture in his office. Whites didn't like him. Blacks, though averse to his religion, appreciated his charisma and his open defiance to the white establishment. He had 6 fights as a heavyweight champion. Ding, ding, ding. Round 2. On April 8th, 1967, he was twice asked to take a step forward to join the army. He refused. He was charged with draft evasion. The New Republic wrote at the time of his death, "The great paradox of Ali is that he was violent in the ring, but in his heart he was a man of love and peace. The greatest act of his life didn't involve fighting, but rather refusing to fight. It was Ali's decision, taken at great personal cost and risk, to defy orders to join the military that launched him as one of America's greatest heroes." Ali famously said, "They ain't done me no wrong, so I ain't got no fight with the Viet Cong." As soon as he didn't take the step, the boxing commission vacated his championship. He was no longer champion. It was run by the white mafia. They also made it so that Ali could not get a license in any place in the country. Eventually, the country kept him from getting a passport. The immediate blowback was both closed-minded and hateful. Jackie Robinson, the man who broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball, said, "He's hurting the morale of a lot of young Negroes in Vietnam. Cassius has made millions, and now he's not willing to show his appreciation to a country that's giving him a fantastic opportunity." Ali said, "I did not lose a thing. I have gained peace of mind. I have gained a peace of heart." This statement was consistent with his religious beliefs. He was clear in his belief that the war was unjust. He knew blacks died disproportionately. His step away as a conscientious objector from the military also involved steps into his integrity and into his religion. In March of 67, Ali meets with Dr. King in Louisville. They find common ground. Dr. King had moved into his own stance against the Vietnam War. Ali and King referred to each other as brothers. King said, I want to say it like King. I can't. "Like Muhammad Ali puts it, we are all black and brown and poor, victims of the same system of oppression. Ali is giving up his fame, giving up millions of dollars to stand for what his conscience tells him is right. No matter what you think of his religion, you have to admire his courage." One writer said King and Ali were the Olympic champions of death threats. Ali was challenged time and time again to change his mind. Later in 67, he met in Cleveland with renowned blacks who wanted him to reconsider. Men that included Jim Brown, Bill Russell, tried to persuade Ali to accept a deal negotiated with the government where he would perform boxing exhibitions in public and the charges would be dropped. Ali worked the room of these men. He got up, he listened, he talked to them, and he worked the room. And soon the men realized that Ali would not change his mind. They could have walked out, but they didn't. Ali had influenced them powerfully. These men then sacrificed some of their own popularity to stand up for religious freedom and to stand up to our government that appeared to be singling out Ali because he was black and outspoken. Bill Russell, I really admire Bill Russell. He's a man known of integrity, the basketball player for the Celtics. He wrote that he envied Ali. "He has something I have never been able to attain and something very few people I know possess. He has an absolute and sincere faith. I am not worried about Muhammad Ali. He is better equipped than anyone I know to withstand the trials in store for him. What I am worried about is the rest of us." Ali said, "They made me bigger than life by taking away my title." He was black, defiant, and ultimately Ali was right. On June 20th, an all-white jury needed only 20 minutes to find him guilty of draft evasion. They sentenced him to 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. He paid a bond and remained free while the verdict was appealed. What kind of hate did he face? David Susskind said, in part, while Ali was on national TV. He is a disgrace to his country, a disgrace to his race. He is a simplistic fool and a pawn. Ali was now in exile from the sport and from making a living. But he was not in exile from the world. He spoke whenever he could, both about Islam and about injustice of the Vietnam War. Campus people liked him, but they didn't like everything he said because he also spoke against interracial marriage, and sometimes he smelled marijuana in the crowd, and he didn't like that. Ali never used any substance, by the way. One author said, he sparred with the students, thus further developing his own voice and his own integrity. He softened his Islamic view. He did not leave the country to avoid the draft. He did not get an MD to give him an undeserved deferment such as a bone spur. Ali stood up tall. He could not make a living from March 1967 to October of 1970. When asked if he missed boxing, Ali said, "No, they missed me." Famed tennis player Arthur Ashe also spoke up. But he said Ali was responsible for it becoming the expected part of black athletes to responsibly get involved. Ashe later fought to acquire a visa to get into South Africa and play tennis. When he was in South Africa playing tennis, he found this young black following him around to all the matches. And he asked the black, "Why is it you're following me around?" He said, "Because you're the first free black man I've ever seen." I suggest to you that was one of many permutations and reverberations and ripples of Ali's influence. "Look at me," Ali says softly, "bigger than boxing, as big as all history." As Ali's consciousness grew, so did ours. The Supreme Court unanimously overturned his conviction. He became one of 170,000 people that were approved as conscientious objectors during the war. His first fight back on October 26, 1970, is against Jerry Quarry. Of course, Quarry's white, and they bill the fight as Quarry is the great white hope. The crowd greeted Ali with, "Ali, Ali, Ali." He was now a martyr and an icon, much different than the last fight he had before not taking the step. Where were you that night when he beat Quarry? I was in Montaillon, France. It's like Gaston, France, okay? I mean, it's a small town. And I knew about the fight, and I wanted to know who won the fight. And I just didn't think I'd be able to know, but I went up to the local épicerie. Did I get that right, Robert? Épicerie? I asked, "Qui gagne la batte, Muhammad Ali avec Jerry Quarry?" And the grocer answered, "Ali gagne la batte." I was at ease. Ali won the fight. After the fight, Coretta Scott King takes his hand. She looks at him and she says, "I want to say that you not only are our champion in the boxing area, but you are also a champion of justice and peace and human dignity. Thank you." This was less than 2 years after her husband died. Ali's goal then was to regain the heavyweight championship stolen from him and to regain financial loss. His boxing accelerated with the fight of the century, Ali versus Joe Frazier, two undefeated heavyweight champions facing each other. He lost. While fans were crushed, Ali essentially said, "Sometimes you lose." It was the first of three fights with Frazier. They were later called by Newsday a brutal trilogy and possibly the greatest rivalry in the history of human combat since David and Goliath. 7 years after being stripped of his title, he got a second chance to reclaim it, fighting George Foreman. People again feared for Ali's health. He was now the older man fighting youth. An estimated 1 billion people tuned in to watch this fight. The fight was in Zaire. It was known as the Rumble in the Jungle. When Ali trained in Africa, natives followed him around. They often said, "Ali Bambaye, Ali Bambaye." It meant kill Frazier. Frazier was also black, but Ali just had some kind of loyalty. While he was in Africa, 20 heads of state visited him. Some believed, and I believe, that Ali was at that time the most famous person on the planet. Foreman had destroyed Frazier 2 times, much as Liston had destroyed Patterson. Ali said, "I've seen George Foreman shadow box. The shadow won." The experts, though, thought there was no chance of an Ali victory. Howard Cosell sounded like he was presiding over a funeral when he said the time may have come to say goodbye to Muhammad Ali, because very honestly, I don't think he can beat George Foreman. Against all odds, Ali knocked Foreman out in the 8th round. People cheered around the world. After the fight, author George Plimpton wrote in part, "It was the sort of joyous reaction that comes with seeing something that suggests all things are possible. The triumph of the underdog. The comeback from hard times and exile. The prevailing of intelligence over power. The success of physical grace. Moreover, it assuaged the guilt feelings of those who remembered the thefts of Ali's career." Ali celebrated in an unexpected way. Peter von Venture followed him to the stoop of his temporary home to find him doing rope tricks for children. Von Venture wrote, "It was hard to tell who was having a better time, Ali or the children. All I could think of was, I don't care what anyone says. There'll never be anyone like him again. Okay, I like you." It wasn't his last fight, but the bee and the butterfly had largely disappeared. He stood flat-footed and tried to win with power. He trained by letting fighters batter him, perhaps trying to toughen himself up. This was not a good plan. His religion became gentler and supported integration. He was in communication with and supported other faiths. Sunni variety of Islam was now his course. Ding, ding, ding. Round 3. Transition to Parkinson's. His last championship fight was in 1980. He was pummeled by heavyweight champion Larry Holmes. Headlines were, "The greatest is gone." He had been told by people who loved him to retire well before 1980. In his career, he had absorbed 200,000 punches. In 84, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. His considerable verbal skills were seriously compromised. My family and I met Ali in 1988. I was thrilled. I looked in his eyes. I said, "Mr. Ali, I admire you. You are important in my life. You stand for peace, social justice. You will always be honored in my memory." He shadow boxed with me. The shadow did not win. The greatest was not gone, but rather moving through a new stage. The first years after his fight was a quiet time as he adapted to the reality of Parkinson's. He continued to attend charity events and spend time in hospitals. His people were thrilled, as I was, for his attention. Then in 1994, Frank Saldo, son of Henry, an attorney that Ali used to work with, stopped in Ali's home and he said, "My dad's in the hospital preparing for heart surgery. Ali said, "Let's go," before being asked. He spoke with Henry for 45 minutes. News spread that Ali was in the house. Doctors and families asked if he would speak with their loved ones. He did. Sadlow swore, a man in a coma opened his eyes. Ali made the rounds with patients, orderlies, kids, and nurses. None of this was unusual behavior for Ali. Sadlow wanted to honor the champ. He campaigned relentlessly to the 1996 Olympic Committee for Ali to light the torch. Who would light the torch was a well-guarded secret. Sadlow was waiting tables in Clarksville, Indiana, on the night of the opening. 80,000 were in the stadium, and hundreds of millions more watched at home on television. Sadlow watched as Atlanta boxer Evander Holyfield ran the symbolic torch into the stadium and did a lap before handing it off to Janet Evans, an Olympic swimmer from Atlanta. Evans ran the torch up the incline, we assume to light the bigger torch. At the top of the incline, from the shadows, came a slow-moving figure dressed in white. Evans handed the torch to Ali. A roar shot through the crowd. Ali, Ali, Ali. Evans said, when she felt the stadium shake, it was the first time she understood his importance. He turned to the crowd, holding the torch in his right hand, with his left hand, palsied, very much shaking, and we wondered how it would turn out. He then grabbed it with both hands and bent to light the wick. If he'd have come to our lighting ceremony, he'd know the wick should come to him. The wick would not light. Would he drop it? Would he be burnt? Would he need help? We wondered. The torch lit, and the crowd roared again. At home, I cried, as I do now. His wife, Lonnie, said that night began the renaissance of Ali. No longer a victim, but rather an inspiration to those with Parkinson's and those with other illnesses. He reemerged for others and for himself. He became more active. He was designated by the United Nations a messenger of peace. He visited hospitals and attended more charity events. We continued to refer to him as the greatest without his urging. The title had little relevance to boxing. At the time of 9/11, he immediately spoke against the terror and reminded us Americans that Islam is a religion of peace. He was the voice of Islam in America. He decided to come to New York City, but he wondered how he would be treated or received. The firemen, the police officers were like me. They wanted to shake his hand and tell him of his importance in their life. He was given by George W. Bush the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He was named Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Century. Not Jordan, not Walter Payton, not Arnold Palmer, Muhammad Ali. This award honored his contributions to humanity. He spoke up during the early stages of the 2016 presidential campaign, urging Muslims to stand up against those who use Islam to advance their own personal agenda. Some compare Ali to Paul Bunyan, the difference being Ali actually existed and walked among us. Slide 14, John. I struggled with this slide. I averted my eyes. I had to come back to it. Then I read a writer, a friend who visited Ali during his last week. This picture was taken during his last week of his life. It was maybe one of the last photos. And he told of the calmness and peace that Ali displayed. And I looked at the picture and I saw calmness and peace in Ali's eyes. And I know we're taught that there's not beauty in age. We're wrong. I looked into this and I wondered, and I knew how this picture fit into this presentation. He was calm and at peace as he readied for the next step to be with Allah. Maybe this is true prettiness. Certainly, Ali's true beauty will never fade. At the time of his death, as planned, Imam Shakir sang loudly with his voice next to Ali's ear. It's a song they sing to Muslims at birth and at death. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. He died hearing those words. 14,000 attended the Jenaza, or funeral. He was repeatedly feted as the people's champion. And Islam, and another imam leader said, Ali emphatically put the question of whether one can be Muslim and American to rest. As Ali wanted people of many faiths and many faiths to be present at his funeral, he had Christians, Catholics, rabbis, Mormons, and Hindus, and a Buddhist, and of course Muslims, and world-famous people spoke and sang about him. It was interesting, the funeral itself was conducted by Muslims, Catholics, and Mormons, again, to Ali's wishes. He wanted, by the way, I think it's funny, he wanted to have an open casket in Yankee Stadium so everyone could see how pretty he was. His wife thought better. An unknown woman said to a member of the family that Ali belonged to all of us. So the takeaway, three takeaways, round one, round two. Round one, as Ali grew his Muslim faith to Sunni, to Sufism, how can we individually and as a congregation be forthright in growing our religion, regardless of what others think? How do you individually attend to your growth? How collectively does and will this congregation do that? It makes sense to me that, like Ali, we become more knowledgeable, more spiritual, more mature, and more gentle in our views. Round two, Ali resisted steps into the military. How do each of us morally resist steps that are in opposition to our integrity? How do we actively, individually, and collectively take the steps that demonstrate and grow what we stand for? Then we can spar fairly with each other's and with others and with each other, even as we differ. In round three, the champ honored Parkinson's. How do we honor who we are individually and collectively within our church? Not just our physical and mental strengths, but also our limitations. Can we be, as Ali was, thankful not only for our blessings, but for the unexpected that we don't want? Simultaneously, as we move forward in this congregation with our behavior, with our faith, and our integrity and love, as we deal with our aging UUCM. Amen.